What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield. With the recent increase of U.S. police officers involved in shootings during routine traffic stops, Dwayne Bryant felt compelled to write The Stop, Improving Police and Community Relations, to educate youth to stop, observe, and reflect during an encounter with law enforcement, teaching principles of mutual respect, shared responsibility, and personal accountability are integral components of building a sustainable relationship with community and authority. Dwayne Bryant, author, mentor, and transformational speaker, recognizes that a key component to diffusing distrust is the changing perspective. Dwayne, welcome to 411 Teen.
Dr. Liz, it is absolutely a pleasure to be here.
I'm so glad to have you. Share with us the impetus for you writing the book and the significance of the title, The Stop.
Sure. Well, there was two reasons that I wrote the book. One, I was doing a workshop with a group of 4th, 5th, and 6th graders from Drake Elementary School on the south side of Chicago. And I asked them a simple question. If you're on a playground playing, minding your own business and doing nothing wrong, if a police car drove over, what would you do? Mm-hmm. And my students said, run. I said, wait a minute. I said, you're doing nothing wrong, you're minding your own business, and you're doing nothing wrong, so why would you run? They said, because we don't want to get shot, and we don't want the police to harass us or to stop us from going home. And I said, whoa, this is not good. A couple of the bigger boys said, well, I wouldn't run, Mr. Bryant, but if they disrespect me, I'm going to disrespect them back. And I said, okay, this is not going to end well for you at all. Literally 2 months later, I had a police encounter that went viral. I was driving from Chicago to Indiana. I was doing 85 and 65. I got pulled over. I crossed 3 lanes of highway. I did not signal because I was trying to get over quickly. And the officer or trooper Weller said, hey, you know, I can either give you a $500 ticket or take you to jail, because in Indiana, it's considered reckless driving when you go 20 miles per hour over the speed limit. And I was like, whoa. You know, I was a little nervous. 2 months prior to that, Sandra Bland had been arrested, she was arrested in Texas, and the officer told her that she crossed 3 lanes of highway without signaling. So
That's
I thought
right.
This was some kind of a white code, that they're going to take me to jail, and 2 days later, I was going to commit suicide. And I just didn't think it was going to end well. So I quickly prayed and asked Lord for some wisdom. And he said, listen, you know who you are. You know who you are. Just have an intelligent conversation. So as I talked to the officer, gave him my ID, he brought back a $150 ticket. And then I said, hey, thank you. Can I take a picture? And he said, why would you take a picture? I said, because I have students who believe that if a black man have an encounter with a white officer, it's going to be a fatality. And I just want to show them with proof that it doesn't have to always go down that way, that you also have power in the stop. It's not just the police officer who has all of the power, but I can control the situation or help the situation with my words, my tone, my body language. And he said, do you understand that? I said, absolutely, officer. You're doing your job. You're trying to, you know, just do your job. And I need to do mine. I was speeding. I know I was, so that's it. He took the ticket, ripped it up, gave me a warning. And so I posted it on Facebook, and it literally went viral. So I just decided that, listen, these two engagements are not mutually exclusive. I believe my kids being terrified of the police, I believe this police encounter, they all are related, and so therefore I wrote the book, The Stop, Improving Police and Community Relations, about 7 personal encounters I've had with law enforcement since elementary school, none of which I've been arrested, none of which I've been to jail, no criminal history, no criminal record, and I thought that I could be able to share and add some service to our country in this very difficult time of policing community.
When you think about those prior encounters that you had when you were younger with police, how did they impact your life and your viewpoint?
Sure. Well, the first one was in elementary school, and we were pulled over, rightfully so, because my mother, you know, being, I would say low income, some people call it poor, we didn't have bicycles. So she believed in education. She sent us to predominantly white schools. And for whatever reason, these kids did not lock their bicycles up. So after school, my brother and I would run out, we'd jump on some bikes and just ride around and bring it right back before my mom got there. This particular day, we stayed out too long. One of the young students came to their brand new bike. We were on it, called the police, and the police saw us riding it, and so he pulled behind us and had a conversation. He had his sirens on, he had his lights on.
Oh, wow.
But my brother and I were respectful because
How old were you?
We didn't challenge his authority. And soon thereafter, my mom came, and they engaged in a conversation, and he let us go. So that taught me many different things. That one, not all police officers are bad, but when you have that encounter, sometimes you're doing things that attract that police attention, and therefore, how are you going to navigate that situation?
How old were you when that encounter occurred?
We were at Lake Sebilia Elementary School, so we were no older than sixth graders because it went to sixth grade, so maybe fifth or sixth grade.
Had you formed your attitudes about police at that point?
At that point, not so much, because you know what's interesting? My father was a police officer, but he left my mom with six kids, so I didn't look at him as a hero police officer or officer friendly. I looked at him as officer, don't take care of your kids. we did have an officer, off-duty officer at the school, Mr. Harmon, and he taught physical education. He was a great guy. So what the kids feel today, I did not feel that at that time.
Okay. I did read your book, and I thought it was very well written, and it spoke directly to the teens, to their parents, and I particularly liked how you included the parents, because they play a key role in how teens cope and deal with authority figures. So I wanted to commend you on how you included that particular component.
Thank you. Thank you. And you know what, Dr. Liz, believe it or not, a lot of the fear, a lot of the intrepidation that our young people have, it also comes from the home.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just police, because when I have conversations with children and with their parents, like if you're at the mall, you'll hear parents say, you see that police officer over there, I'm going to have him arrest you if you don't come over here. Well,
right.
What does that do? That
right.
Feels fear.
Mm-hmm.
Or, hey, you see that police officer over here, if you don't do what I'm telling you to do, if you don't stop talking, I'm going to send you to jail.
Mm-hmm.
That's terrible for a parent to do.
Mm-hmm.
And parents do that, and I believe subconsciously they do not have a clue as the impact that that kind of fear has on their child.
That's a good point. I'm sure that they don't have it. They just are looking for something to help them control
Correct.
And enforce, you know, their expectations and laws. So that's what's going on with that. What role do you think the school plays? Because it's every aspect, every component has a different role, okay? And what role do you think that the school plays and how they approach policemen?
I think the school has a huge role. This is why. When you look at the statistics and the data that's coming out, the average parent spends less than 15 minutes a day actually instructing and talking to their children. That means that the school teachers in the school really have more talk time and sometimes a greater impact and influence on our young people. So if that's the case, then we have to begin to instruct, to inform, to educate teachers on how to have this very important conversation with the young people as it relates to law enforcement. There are many schools that have an SRO officer or a school resource officer within the school. That SRO officer should also be engaging with the young people in conversation. If it's only from a disciplinary standpoint, if it's only from a standpoint of arrest, then that creates fear, that creates disrespect, that creates tension. And I believe that the schools have to be a positive and a proactive part of the whole solution to improve police and community relations.
Now, in addition to the school, of course, we know that that home milieu, that home environment is very important. How parents approach and how they view the police is very important because kids are going to pick up on their parents.
So, listen, when the police pulls over, and mom is like, what that blank you stopped me for? I know I ain't doing a god blank thing wrong. The kid goes, oh, okay. That's how you're supposed to treat police officers.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work so well for the kid. It doesn't work well for the mom either.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So we're going to have to get the parents to understand that they have to take a different approach. And who knows, the results for them may indeed be different, too.
Right, right. And, you know, let me say this, too, on behalf of parents. Before I published the book, I let a few parents read it just to get an idea of what they thought from a parenting standpoint. And one parent said, "Dwayne, I have a husband in the home, and we talked to my kid, Matthew, and we did not realize he was afraid of the police." She said that, you know, we're respectful. So sometimes you can have good parents in the home who teach respect, but because the students' children are watching television and listening to their friends,
mm-hmm.
they have a level of fear. And she said, "Can you create a workbook? Because we don't even know how to engage this conversation with our young person. We don't even know where to start." So I literally created a workbook for parents to be able to read with their children, to be able to have certain conversations so that they can understand how does your child feel and be able to help instruct them with better information and better guidance. Because the reality is, Dr. Liz, a lot of parents just tell their kids, "Look, be safe. Don't do nothing wrong and get home."
That's true.
None of that is a strategy.
Share with us the name of your workbook, where we can get it, because I think everything will be very beneficial. Someone listening
might
want
it. Sure, they can get it a few places. One is directly from my website, which is aboutthestop.com. That's aboutthestop.com. If they order from my website, I will autograph it. I will mail it personally. And I will also, it's a color copy. Or they can get it from amazon.com, and they have to put in the stop, improving police and community relations, because there are a few other books called The Stop, and it may not come up as just The Stop. If they get it from Amazon, on my website it's $17.99. On Amazon, I believe it's $23.88, but it's black and white from Amazon. Or they can get it from Kindle. They can download it directly to their Kindle. And also on my website, they can get the paper book or the audio book, or they can go to Audible and get the audio book. It's actually me in the studio. We got sound effects on it. And they can get it from Apple. I think it's iBooks from Apple as well. So
okay.
Just about every possible medium. If you want it, you can get it. If you can't read, you can listen. If you're blind, you can hear it. However you want to get it, but you need to get the stuff.
Okay, hold your thoughts for a moment. We're going to take a brief break. You're tuned in to 411 Team. What's the 411? You're tuned into 411 Teen, a conversational forum for teens and other interested folks. This hour, I'm talking with Dwayne Bryant, an internationally renowned editor, motivational speaker, and TV personality. His new book, The Stop, Improving Police and Community Relations, is now available in another number of different venues. Dwayne, I had to interrupt you. You were talking about where you could secure your book, but we were also talking about just the world that teens live in, their school, their community. And basically what you're saying, and you correct me if I'm wrong, is it does take a village because it's all different perspectives.
Absolutely. Just like you have good and not-so-good police officers, you have good and not-so-good parents.
Mm-hmm.
You have good and not-so-good students. You have good and not-so-good teachers. So the reality is, I believe the vast majority of us are good, decent people trying to do good in society. So therefore, those of us who are, we have to, you know, help. We have to help the village. We have to make sure we cover for each other. We respect each other. And we provide some accountability and responsibility to make sure that our children are able to reach their destiny safely.
Well, Dwayne, you are a strong advocate of mentoring. What is it about mentoring that you find is so effective?
Well, to be honest with you, I was that child. I used to be a bully. I used to fight. I got put out of an elementary school. I didn't care about education early on in life until I had a teacher named Ms. Barbara Bay that taught world history from an Afrocentric perspective. I've been watching the PBS specials with Dr. Gates, and it's like, whoa, this is the stuff that turned me on. When I began to understand the history of my ancestors and where we came from, the greatness versus just being slaves that most history books in America teach our people, that's when I began to make a decision. Listen, I'm a king. I'm not a slave. My 1619 ancestors were slaves, but before that, we were kings and queens. So as a result of that, graduating from high school, full academic scholarship to college, working in the corporate world, resigning at 27, I just knew that because God had been so great in my life, and I had a mentee in St. Louis when I first met this gentleman. He had a 1.5 GPA. He was selling drugs. He was running in a gang. And as I began to mentor him one-on-one, this brother has graduated from high school. He's graduated from college. He was a regional manager for C.F. Chain. He studied in Ghana. And I just saw the power of a powerful mentor, the impact that it can have on someone's life. And I thought, okay, if I did it one time, certainly I can be able to help impact thousands more lives.
How do you inspire teens to step out of their comfort zone? And I'm thinking particularly when their environment, when their community is in opposition. For example, gangs. You know, now gangs, we may have a negative impact, but they also can have a positive impact for those teens who don't have family, who need to feel connected. Gangs can serve some purpose. So how do you get them to move away from those gangs where they feel secure and loved, or move away from selling those drugs where that is the only way that they can have any type of economic mobility, or at least as they see it? What does one do? What kind of clues can you give us to take that step with teens?
Sure, and that is an absolutely brilliant and beautiful question. The young man I was talking about, his name is Sharon Hopkins. Now, let's just look at the reality. He was selling drugs. He was running in a gang. After a couple of months of working with Sharon, this is what he actually told me. He said, listen, the reason why I'm really meeting with you is because you have a clientele that I want to tap into. You have educated corporate people. If I can sell my drugs to that clientele, you can work with me. We can do this together. I said, boy, have you lost your monkey mind? I could not believe he thought he was Nino Brown. I said, listen, young bro, we do the same things. I said, you sell drugs, I sell drugs, I sell drugs for the biggest drug maker in the world, Johnson & Johnson. Mm-hmm. It don't get much bigger than that. Mm-hmm. I said, you do sales, I do sales. You do distribution, I do distribution. You do finance, I do finance. You do marketing, I do marketing. And so, therefore, we do the same things. I said, but let me tell you the difference between you and I. One, you're dumb, I'm intelligent. Two, you'll be dead by 30, I'll still be living. Three, I'll have a good-looking wife and some intelligent kids. You won't, you'll be dead or in jail. I'll have better cars than you that are mine. I can drive down the street and not have to look over my shoulder and wonder who's trying to kill me. I won't have to stand on the street corner all doggone day because I can go to a job, and then I'll have a good reputation. So let me ask you this. Which life do you prefer? And he just paused. He said, I didn't think about it like that. I said, exactly. You're not thinking, which is why you're selling stupid drugs to stupid people buying these drugs. So let's be intelligent and let's change your life around. And so what I was able to do was show him, not just tell him, but show him a better way, show him what I was doing, show him what kind of money I was making, and show him how I can go home safely. So a lot of times, you're right, these young people choose gangs because it's a sense of protection. It's a sense of safety, but the reality is it's only a sense of because it's not really true. It's like an illusion because once they cross the gang, they end up dead as well. Once they don't bring in the money or don't stay out long enough to sell the drugs or whatnot, then they end up dead or hurt or something like that. So this whole gang family culture, it's an illusion. Very few people that I know of, and actually I don't know of any, have actually retired from a gang. I've never seen gangs, you know, do things positive and constructive in the community. If you're destroying your community, to me, you are not worthy of breathing. Mm-hmm. So I'm not a fan of it at all. I don't have much tolerance for it. I listen to the young people tell me what they're doing, but I just want to show them a better way. And there's enough young, educated professionals out here who could show the young people a better way for them to make that decision.
And that's where that mentoring comes right in.
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, Dwayne, I know at 27, you left your, six-figure job to go and pursue other sites. Share that with us. Tell us what happened.
Well, let me tell you, first of all, I miscalculated, Dr. Liz, because I thought, ooh, I'm going to quit my job and I'm just going to go make it happen. Lord Jesus, I tell everybody, do your budget first. I forgot I had a company car. I forgot I had a corporate expense account.
Oh,
I didn't pay for a car. I didn't pay for gas. I didn't pay for insurance and a whole lot of other stuff because we had a corporate account. So when I did my little budget, I didn't add up correctly. The other thing I never calculated was I was going to get a contract with Chicago Public Schools in February. They were not going to pay me until July. So now I'm catching the CTA bus and a train to go to the school, not getting paid, maxing out my credit card, living downtown Chicago in the winter. I'm getting red bills coming in saying, hey, we're about to shut your phone off, your gas off, your lights off. So it was, when I tell you, it was the most difficult time in my life because I'm an educated brother. I worked Johnson & Johnson in the corporate world, came out of college making money to be broke, to have a 480 credit score.
No.
It was humiliating. It was embarrassing. I couldn't date. I was too broke to pay attention, so I wasn't going to try to ask no woman out for no doggone date. And so, but I just knew I had a dream. I knew I had a passion. I knew I was good with the young people, so that's what I did. So the first part of mentoring, that's when I knew this is what I'm called to do. Because there was a point, I remember, I didn't show up for a week.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this young man named Dwight Good. When I came back to the school at Corliss High School, he said, Mr. B, where were you? I said, man, look, man, they ain't even paying me. I'm coming out here with you guys weekly, and I just don't think I can do it anymore. And he said, so you're going to be just like everybody else, huh?
Mm-hmm.
You say you're going to stick through, you say you're going to come out here, and then you never show up again. Why did you even come? And I was like, whoa. And so that's when I realized my personal problem is my personal problem. It has nothing to do with them. And so I had to suck it up, and that's when I was like, God, I was walking down Michigan Avenue, and I was angry, like, how you going to tell me to leave my job? I'm just talking to the God like he was a kid. And the Holy Spirit whispered and said, if you keep talking, whatever you say is going to happen. I was like, ooh. So then I started talking. I'm going to be successful. We will mentor thousands. We will make millions. And so all of that has come to fruition.
Well, you've got to have a positive approach and a positive attitude. So that's just
Absolutely.
What you did. That's what you incorporated into your style, that positivity. You talk a lot about developing a meaningful dialogue. Share with us, listening audience, just what a meaningful dialogue is composed of.
I heard some of that. You said, share with us a meaningful
You talk a lot about a meaningful dialogue, having a meaningful dialogue. And I just wanted you to share with the listening audience just what a meaningful dialogue is composed of.
Sure. And that meaningful dialogue can be parent with child, it could be teacher with student, it could be law enforcement with community, it could be faith-based organizations with their congregation or their audience, it could be, you know, just community in a town hall meeting. That dialogue is about how do we come together again to respect each other? How do we come together again where we take responsibility, where we take accountability, where we're raising our kids to be intelligent people? That's the dialogue, because I believe one thing that's missing in our society is a level of humanity. It seems as though people really don't care about each other anymore. We don't care about our neighbor. We don't even know our neighbor. So that dialogue is to begin to engage in constructive conversation. A lot of grown-ups are scared of young people. A lot of young people don't respect older people. So that dialogue is wherever it is. Like when I get pulled over, and I still get pulled over, I've had over 13 police encounters, I have a little conversation. You know, hey, how are you? How's your day-to-day? If the person is rude or whatnot, don't want to talk, then I respect that. But when I see young people on the street, you know, I have a conversation. If I see a guy with his pants down, I'm like, Well, man, now you know you're a king. Why you got your pants like that? Oh, my bad, my bad. You know, it's just like, you know, just little conversation. I grew up in the South. In the South, black people talk to each other. We said, hello, how are you? How are you today? When I moved to Chicago, I would walk down the street and people don't even talk. You can be in an elevator and people don't even say hello. I was like, whoa.
A rude awakening. Yeah. Individuals often speak from their own personal experiences. Many people of color experience antagonistic, negative interactions with law authorities, of which both groups are to blame. How do you encourage individuals to let go of stereotypes and biases that they may harbor about a particular group? Because I think that is often a basis of how we interact with each other, that we have these preconceived ideas.
That's another great question. I have developed a workshop that every police department needs, every college and university needs, every corporation needs, every public school needs. And in that workshop, I talk about the origins, and I go back not to 1619, but I go back about 7,000, 8,000, 10,000, 25,000 years ago. I talk about the beginning and the origins of human beings in Africa. I talk about the Great Migration pattern. I talk about, you know, the pyramids. I talk about the European advancements. I talk about the ancient Incas and the Aztecs and the Toltecs, the Ming Dynasty, the Kublai Khan Dynasty. But it all started in Africa. Ramesses, the builders of the pyramid, you know, King Khufu and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. So once you understand that every group of people had an opportunity to positively impact this world and try to advance civilization, and every group of people tried to run the world and rule the world, but it's just unfortunate that man just not do a great job at that because we always get ego and big-headed and we mess things up. However, in our history, we show everything in this country that anything black was dumb, was ignorant, was no respect. So therefore, there are people who literally believe that because they've been taught that in school textbooks. They've been taught that over the media. Mm-hmm. They've been taught that, you know, on the radio. So I can understand, like, some of my Facebook friends are rural white people who never knew black people. And as we engage in dialogue, I have a level of empathy because my thing is, listen, I'm not going to leave you ignorant. If you have a conversation with me, you're going to learn a whole bunch. So in that engagement, people are like, whoa, I never knew. I'm like, I get it, because it's been systematically designed for you not to know.
Exactly.
You cannot have a white supremacist structure and then you elevate other people. So white supremacy has to make black look dumb and ignorant, brown look dumb and ignorant, yellow and red look dumb and ignorant, so it gives you a basis to annihilate or eradicate those people. But intelligent people want to know the truth. All races of people have impacted positively this culture, this civilization, and this world. And so I teach that, and then we talk about implicit bias. We talk about explicit bias, because we all have those biases.
Indeed.
But once you understand, that is your internal problem.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to make my internal problem an external problem, and therefore other people have to be impacted by it. And that's a personal conversation and a personal decision.
Let me ask you, when are you coming this way? I know Florida is home, but you know, the reason I ask is they have just started, I think in the Sheriff's Department, an initiative to improve and develop the relations between community and law enforcement. And in fact, they have one person that they have identified who will be focusing on this. It would be great if you came through here.
Listen, this is how easy I am. I'm as easy as someone calling me. They can reach me at DwayneBryant.com, about the stop.com,
mm-hmm.
and saying, hey, this is what we have, if the dates match up. Now, remember, I have people on my payroll,
mm-hmm.
so don't say, man, we'd love for you to come, but we don't have budgets. Let's just move past that silly conversation. We're all professional, so let me know what the budget is.
Right.
I got to get there. I got to have a rental car to get there, because I know Southwest doesn't fly to Tallahassee. and, you know, a hotel. And then let's engage the community. So they can reach me at DwayneBryant.com. I would absolutely love to come. I'm in South Florida quite a bit and Orlando quite a bit because I was raised and born in Orlando.
I know.
Grew up in a small town called Eatonville, Florida. Went to Winter Park High School. I have a buddy of mine, Dr. John Walford. He's a professor at FAMU. So I would absolutely love to come to Tallahassee and engage with the students, with the police, with the community, and the police will be safe because I'm not about bashing law enforcement. I'm about respecting law enforcement, but I'm also about mutual respect, which takes both, accountability, which takes both, and shared responsibility, which takes both.
Okay. In the community, you're talking about the whole community, church, recreation department.
Absolutely.
How do you incorporate churches?
Well, churches is easy because I've done workshops in churches. I've actually developed a team ministry in churches. But with the book, is about every church usually have a youth ministry. Every church usually have like a Young Lions or a young men's program, a young women's program. They can literally get, I would recommend churches get the bundle pack, which is the book, the workbook, and the Stop Challenge poster. They can literally have that adult to speak with, work with the young people, because each chapter is just beautifully written and it's designed. You read the book, so you're able to draw out questions for the students that's in the back of the book, but then they can get the workbook so that the young people can begin to write out their thoughts, their expressions. One thing young people don't do very well now is their writing is terrible because everyone is texting. They're not spelling. They're using, you know, LOL instead of laugh out loud is LOL. So the workbook will allow that adult to personally engage with the young people.
I'm talking with Dwayne Bryant, author of The Stop, Improving Police and Community Relations. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. Dwayne, I'm sorry I had to interrupt you, but would you continue?
Yes, absolutely. So I would say the church would engage by getting the bundle pack, the book and the workbook, so they can have make sure all of the students have a workbook and really a book. They can go through chapter by chapter. They can do it in as little as 8 weeks, or they can extend it throughout a full year program because the young people are coming to the church for guidance and for direction. And if you, it's great to teach Jesus. This is wonderful. But Jesus also taught respect, taught love for your fellow man, and that also includes law enforcement, et cetera. And I think the church is an ideal place for these conversations to be had.
According to, based on your perspective and your interaction, what would you identify as the major problems between community and police relations?
Sure. I think the major problem is two problems on two different sides. I think you have a lawless element, a criminal element within law enforcement, and I think you have a criminal element within the community. And what happens is law enforcement, the minority of those folk who are criminal elements, it could be as small as 2%, 3%, what they do is they have a blue wall of silence. They cover for each other. What the community does is we have people selling drugs in our neighborhood, people who are killing kids, but we don't say anything. So we create a community wall of silence, or I'll say a black or a white or a brown wall of silence. So now what happens is you don't have trust. Whenever the police do their things and they take up for each other, the community doesn't trust them. Whenever the community have criminals that we take up for, we don't, as we say in the streets, snitch on, then the police doesn't trust us. So what happens is it's great for the criminal because now they keep this chaos, but the good, intelligent, decent people, they usually oftentimes lack leadership and courage to say, no, I'm not going to stand for this. We're going to have a level of excellence and a standard of excellence, regardless of if you're my brother, if you're my cousin, or if you live around my community, or if you're also on my police force. And so, therefore, the biggest problem is lack of leadership in the police department and lack of leadership in the community, period.
And we're being hypocritical in the community, particularly when, you know, we want to call the police to protect us. Yet when someone, one of us kills us, we don't want to say anything.
You better read my book.
Yeah. Do you think we've learned anything from this recent, all these recent police shootings of unarmed people of color?
Well, I think we're learning as it goes. Unfortunately, I don't believe this is a new phenomenon. Mm-hmm, I think this has been happening since Jim Crow, since the Black Code, since the 60s. I think because of the cell phones now, it allows us to see just how often it is happening. So I think we are learning, but I think the pace in which we're learning is too slow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everyone would rather protest, they'd rather march, they'd rather shout, they'd rather cry. I ain't got time for none of that.
Mm-hmm.
I want to create solutions. I want to bring the key players to the table. I want accountability. If you shot somebody and you were not, you know, within the lawful means of your job, if you profiled, you had implicit, explicit bias, you need to be fired and put in jail, period. If you're in the community and you're selling drugs and you're killing somebody, we need to out you out so that you can serve your time and hopefully get transformed in the criminal justice system. I have very little tolerance for criminals and criminal behavior, no matter which side of the fence it falls on.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, what we're learning is people are becoming more and more intolerant. I'm hoping what we're learning is let's become intolerant so we get towards solutions instead of just becoming intolerant and now we have more division.
What type, you talk about solutions, what type of solutions have you identified?
Well, the new buzzword is community policing,
mm-hmm.
and I'm completely okay with that. But I think that it is very difficult to police a neighborhood or a group of people or a community if you have no respect for them, if you have no regard for them, if you don't have no understanding of the culture of that community, you will not be effective officer, period, because you will come with your bias. You will come with your, you know, preconceived notions of what it is. So therefore, I believe every police department, they need some serious training on de-escalation. They need to be able to spend some time in the communities with the people, getting to know the people, because it makes them a more effective officer. So I believe training is huge. I believe training is also huge for the community because parents got to learn,
mm-hmm.
you know, to have better conversation with their young people, to know how to interact with law enforcement so they can get better results.
Do you think that law enforcement needs to live in the community to be effective?
You know, that's something that we're discussing right now. The new law here in Chicago, and actually I've just gotten authorization to begin working with the city on this problem, so I'm so excited about it. You're going to hear about this. It's going to be big. Now, in order to be a Chicago Police Department officer, you have to live in the city of Chicago. But Chicago is so big, you can live on the north side and never even venture into the south side or the west side. I don't think that if I need to patrol Inglewood, that I need to live in Inglewood. I don't think that. But I do believe that if you're going to be an officer in certain cities, you have to know the culture.
Mm-hmm.
You have to know the population. You have to know the history of that community. And you have to have it taught to you in a level where you have respect for the people you're patrolling. It is very easy to dehumanize somebody. And if officers are dehumanizing a community, then they're also terrorizing that community.
What should teens do when they are stopped? I know there's a recipe of what they actually should do. How should they handle that?
Oh, that's a great question. This is what I say, and I say this in the book. Remember when we were learning how to drive, they said when you come to a stop sign, you stop, you look, you listen, and you look both ways, then you proceed with caution. So I start with that general premise. When I am approached by a police officer or when I'm stopped by an officer, I stop. I look both ways. Look both ways meaning I look to the right, look into my future. What are my goals in my life? What do I want in life?
Mm-hmm.
Do I want this 30-minute encounter to dictate the rest of my life in a negative way? Heck no. So that means I need to be mindful of my tone. I need to be mindful of my body language. I need to be mindful of the words that I'm saying. So therefore, I'm looking right. Now I need to look left. Okay, what did this officer stop me for? I don't know. So I don't need to be belligerent. I don't need to be, you know, disrespectful and rude. I need to be respectful. I need to be the officer. Because oftentimes, especially with vehicular stops, there's something or a violation that we've done that we don't even know we've done. So if we jump right to the attitude, right to the bad day, well, guess what? Police officers are human beings as well. They also have bad days. And so, therefore, if we go in and they having a bad day and we having a bad day, it's going to be a bad day. So that's the first thing I say. The second thing I say is answer the questions. If you're driving a car, you're supposed to have your driver's license. So let's not quote the Constitution. Pull your doggone driver's license out. If you're driving, you also need your registration or your insurance. So have those papers ready. But don't move too suddenly because, according to all the research, many people get shot because the police say they're in fear of their life, that they thought they had a weapon. So keep your hands on that steering wheel. If it's at night, turn on your dome light because what you want to do is disarm the law enforcement officer. They never, you never want to give them a reason to pull that gun. And people would say, well, why do black people have to teach their kids that and white people don't? White people do. They just don't broadcast it. We love to go on the news and broadcast our stuff. Let's see, respect, thinking both ways, compliance. If the officer asks for your ID, give them the ID. And now you also need to know your law. You know, need to know your constitutional rights. You do not have the right to search and seizure of me, my property, my personal possessions. There's a difference between probable cause and reasonable suspicion. You know, if an officer thinks you have a firearm, then they can kind of pat you down. But then you can ask that officer, hey, am I being detained? Am I being arrested? And if they say no, then they have to stop. If they say, if you say, well, I do not consent to any more further search, then they have to stop by law. So I think young people should know the laws. They should know the rules and regulations. They should know their constitutional rights. But they should also know that they have the right to be respectful. They have the right to engage with this law enforcement officer with respect so that everyone gets home safely.
I particularly like the example that you gave when in your book when a teen was stopped and he had some of his friends in the vehicle with him, and they started spouting off, okay? And you made it real clear that the driver needs to be aware that they are responsible. They're responsible to make sure that their passengers have their seatbelts on, but they're also responsible to make sure that their passengers shut up, okay?
That's hilarious. I actually say that in the book. You're talking about chapter 3. I say, listen, you need to tell your friends to shut up because you're correct. The driver is responsible for that entire car.
Right. And I don't think they know that, though. I mean, I thought that that was a real important point that you made there. Okay. Because so often you'll see, you know, one, they'll get stopped and everybody else will be mouthing off. And maybe the driver is trying to be compliant. So everybody needs to understand that they need to shut up. They really do. What about the impact? What impact does that nonverbal communication have? I mean, the posture, the eye contact, the attire. And maybe folks say, well, we ought to be able to wear anything we want. But it does send a message. Would you agree?
I'm loving you, Dr. Liz, because you I can tell you're really passionate about the young people, and you really want them to understand their power. The nonverbals are very important. According to the research, people listen and respond to only 7% of the words that you say, 38% of your tone, and 55% of your body language. Therefore, the vast majority of your communication is nonverbal. And I tell people, and I tell young people all the time, people are judging you all the time. We judge all the time. They judge all the time.
Right.
According to the research, what you look like does have an impact on the outcome. As a matter of fact, I think it's on page 41, the Police Policy Studies Council of Interdisciplinary Research Training says that there's a significant correlation that exists between the officer action and the subject action. What they're wearing comes into play. How they look comes into play. There's a significant correlation between the officer's actions and two attributes, the subject's age and the subject's dress. Let me say that again. There's a significant correlation exists between the officer's action and two attributes of the subject, their age and how they dress. Now, they call it in here punk dress. But I say, listen, what they're saying is thug dress. You got that long white T-shirt on. You got that hat cocked to the side.
Mm-hmm.
So that has an impact. It has a perception. Because when I go to Cook County right now, I'm a 70-plus percent of the boys in Cook County that got those long locks. Does it mean long locks make you a criminal? No,
nope.
It doesn't. I'm just telling you what the stats are.
Mm-hmm.
So you decide what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
You can pull your pants up. That's not a law. You don't need that. You can wear a shirt that's either tucked in or, you know, a shirt that looks decent. You can do that. You can't control your age. So young people need to understand that their presence dictates many different outcomes. Now, I have nieces and nephews, and they say, well, Uncle D, you know, what about these white boys? They walk around in packs, and they look like this, too, and they don't get the same treatment. They are absolutely right. My objective is let's deal with where we are right now. The fact is many officers dehumanize black kids. Many officers look at black kids as threats and thugs, et cetera, et cetera. So if that's the case, let's be mindful so that we don't attract any unnecessary attention, because eventually we'll get the policies right. Eventually we'll get the right officers in the job and get the wrong ones off the job, but we're not there yet.
And what about when they stop you and you're listening to music? Would you suggest they turn it off? Some of the lyrics can be somewhat questionable or inappropriate. And I think that that also sends a message.
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, when I got pulled over the last one that went viral, it was interesting. I was listening to Ocean, so I'm just worshiping. Woo, Lord, love you. And then I turned on Biggie. Boom. Biggie. And I literally started speeding. I mean, my body language, I had the music blasting. When that police officer pulled me over, trust me, the first thing I doggone did was turn Biggie off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, if you're having that loud music at the officer stops you, it's disrespectful having it on. How can he even hear you? How can he have a conversation, or she, without, you know, that loud noise? And some of the rap, though, I'm going to tell you, and I tell the young people, some of the garbage they listen to is just that it's garbage.
Yeah.
And they listen to it so much. You got someone rapping that I don't like a snitch blank, I don't like a this, I don't
mm-hmm.
like. They don't like nothing that's positive and productive. So then what do you like?
Mm-hmm.
They got songs about how they're going to take a girl and turn her out and do this
mm-hmm.
and do that and just jabber and all this. This is crazy. And these songs is mental programming. So
right.
Young people got to have enough self-esteem to understand that if I'm listening to ignorance, I'm programming ignorance in my mind, and I will act ignorantly.
Okay. What about the consequences of these poor decisions? Because I don't think they recognize the consequences of their behavior. How do we enforce?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
How do we make the point that their behavior has consequences, immediate consequences, and some long term consequences?
Yeah. Well, the facts are, again, scientifically speaking, the prefrontal cortex is not developed on a human being until the mid-20s. That's the ability to make long-term decisions, to make, you know, intelligent, informed decisions. The prefrontal cortex on a young person is not developed, so they make emotional decisions based on
mm-hmm.
rational and logical decisions. And so, therefore, you know, every young person thinks they're smarter than they are, they think they're growner than they are, they think they're more mature than they are. So it's just not there. So on one hand, law enforcement have to understand, okay, if I'm dealing with a 10-year-old, I don't care what they look like, how they act, I'm dealing with a 10-year-old. We need to give them some allowances that we would want our own children to be given. So therefore, we can't dehumanize. We can't treat a 14-year-old kid like he's a 20-year-old man. Now, mind you, in some neighborhoods, 14-year-olds act like 20-year-olds. But still, it's still a kid. So I think that we need to make allowances on both sides of the fence. Law enforcement, as well as the community. Parents just need to do a better job of their kids. Parents need to know what their kids are doing, what their kids are listening to. I do social media workshops with parents, and they don't have a clue the stuff. These elementary school kids are on porn sites. They're watching more porn than their parents are watching porn. So parents need to get a handle on being a parent. Stop trying to be friends and know that children are listening to and what they're doing.
Okay, well, listen, I appreciate it so much. Thank you for sharing your expertise and your experience with us. To my listening audience, tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. This edition of 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistant, Ken Smith. Audio copies are available, and if you want to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Teen podcast, log in wfsu.org. Check us out on Facebook.